Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Experience the thrill of the race with Scalextric, proud sponsors of the Motorsport Podcast.
Tom Christensen, British Touring Car Championship race winner, DTM race winner, Goodwood race winner, Formula 3000 race winner, Japanese Formula 3 champion, World Endurance champion, Petit Le Mans winner, six-time Sebring 12 Hours winner, and of course, nine-time Le Mans winner. Of the 18 Le Mans 24 Hours he contested, he either didn't finish or he finished on the podium. An extraordinary record. Tom Christensen, welcome. Tom, grab a seat.
Oh, thank you very much. I mean, the picture, it's actually, I didn't know that my nose was that bent. but it's sometimes in life, it's good to see that. So
it could be worse.
Yeah, very nice photo.
Yeah, it could be worse. It could be my nose. look, the Le Mans Centenary, we met up this afternoon.
Yeah.
And talked about this year, because it's such an enormous year. You're sort of run off your feet. Do you, you know, when you went to the event, I think in Paris, and you were with Jackie Ickx, Derek Bell, Emanuele Pirro, Henry Pescarolo, I saw was there. I mean, the huge number of Le Mans wins. Has your place in the history of the race kind of sunk in? Are you kind of comfortable with it?
Yeah, I think now after my retirement, it's kind of, but it's just that when you're in it, it just goes so fast, in that sense. But sunk in, it's simply a great evening we had in Paris last night at the Rodin Museum, and we drove these cars up, and then when we stand there, in our, everyone was in black tie. We were in our driver overalls. For that event, and just stand there with I think, I don't know exactly how many wins it was we had together, but I mean, Jackie and me is 15 plus 5 of Derek, that's 20 plus 5 from, so it's 25, so it's 29 wins, I think, with us five drivers. Yeah. So, of course, the story just goes, and one is talking, one is listening, and one takes over, and there we have the cars, which we drove up onto the stage. I had the pleasure of driving the Bentley, the 3-liter Bentley, which won Le Mans, as many people know, in 1924. A similar car did the fastest lap the previous year, which was the first ever Le Mans in 1923, where the Chenard Walker won the race. And Bentley had the fastest lap, but not the win before the following year. So this car, it's very extraordinary. I mean, it drives what you would say, are you saying around 100 miles an hour, I think, on the straights. 800 years ago.
And the steering is probably more of a guide than a precise instrument.
Yeah, it's it's sailing a little bit, but nevertheless, it's pretty cool. And then Jackie Ickx drove the GT40, a similar car to what his debut at Le Mans, I believe, it was 1966, when he did his first race at Le Mans. Derek Bell drove the Porsche 917, the Langhek, the golf car. Emmanuel Pirro drove the Ferrari.
Yeah.
Which
512.
It's one from 72, I think. Yeah. Yeah, it's a beautiful car with Marsario driving at that time. So, and then Henri Pescarolo drove his own Matra, the one he won with Gérard Larousse.
Yeah.
The final victory.
I was going to ask this nearer the end, but obviously, you know, we'll get on to what you do kind of now and the racing you still do. There are some drivers that can just switch off. They retire and they're done and they're quite happy. Jackie Stewart is sort of prime example. Did you find it tough going back to Le Mans for the first time not driving?
Yeah, Jackie Stewart was there last night as well, among others. But it's difficult to make the decision to stop racing. That was very difficult. And that took me a lot of time to do that. But when I did it, I wanted to do an extra race to prove that I was still and trying to feel that you're still going out on top. My last race was in Brazil, 2014. We finished on the podium, best Audi, but we didn't win. But I still believe I did a strong race. So in that sense, I still believe that I can just jump back and do it the same. So this is what I do when I miss it.
Yeah.
That's how I think, and that's how I kind of do my, when I work for TV, both around Le Mans or Formula One, I use all that sort of passion and energy and put myself in the driver's seat in that way. So yeah. that has been very helpful. But I certainly miss racing at times, but I don't regret my retirement at all. It was a perfect timing for me, and don't forget, I was 47 when I retired. So,
yeah, mate, it's still look young.
Yeah, but absolutely, Fernando Alonso. I mean, I interviewed him in Baku on the grid. I said, "Hey, you're good. It's good to see you. the old guy's going strong."
Yeah.
And
Let's talk about 97, your first experience. We've actually got a photo of you at that race. It was funny because you were so busy with your single seater career, and you got a very late call up for 97, didn't you?
Yeah, I've just spent 5 years in Japan. As you said, I won the Formula 3 in Germany and then in Japan, driving all kinds of cars in Japan. I really love Japan. That's really important for me. And I think that helped the foundation for somebody calling me. I was actually doing 3,000 in Europe, and I was playing tennis with my one of my best mates, or relatively, because he beat me in everything I did. So obviously very competitive, but it was very good for me to train whatever we did. In winter, it was squash. In the summer, football. And now it was tennis. And then I got a call on a thing is 97, on a big mobile phone I had at that time, and it was ringing. And I don't think if I hadn't been behind there in the third set, I might not have answered the phone. And there was this German guy, Ralf Jüttner. Tom, können wir dich für Le Mans? Also in German, he was explaining that they were looking for a driver for Le Mans to partner Michael Alboreto and Stefan Johansson. And just very fast thinking, I mean, but the decision had to be tomorrow because this was Wednesday or Thursday evening, and Le Mans was starting with the scrutineering the next Tuesday. So it was a very late call. But why I mentioned Japan was that there was a few people involved in that, like Domingos Piedade, the Portuguese guy who was quite influential in motorsport. He had suggested to Jos they should take me because he traveled quite a lot to Japan with his connection with Bridgestone, using for AMG and Mercedes. So he has seen me there. And he knew me from Germany when I won the F3 championship, but you know, that's 5 or 6 years earlier. But he said, go for him. Don't go for an experienced guy. Take Tom. And that has been juggling between the team manager, Ralf Jüttner, who called me, and the owner, Reinhard Joest, who probably would like a driver with budget and experience. And I didn't have any of that. But at the end of the day, I ended up a few days later, I was sitting in the car.
But your seat fit wasn't, it was a bit of a wake-up call, wasn't it?
No, the seat fit is, yeah, it's really a great anecdote for my career because I flew down for a seat fitting or meeting the team, but the team had left. So there was only the secretary, Ralf Jüttner, and the boss, Reinhard Joest, there. And we made the contract and we agreed. But then he showed me around in the workshop where he had several cars from the past when Reinhard Joest drove himself. That was a lot of beautiful cars. But then in the corner, there was a monocoque. And there was one mechanic who was sweeping the floor, And he said, oh, by the way, that's the test car from last year. That's exactly the same chassis as you're going to drive, which was the TWR Porsche, which is actually a bit based on the Jaguar as the chassis. The chassis is identically to the Jaguar chassis. I jumped up in the monocoque, and they said, oh, you see, everything is inside from last year. That's Michele's seat. And partnering Michele Alboreto, I said, yeah, it's perfect. I absolutely sit perfect. And then I realized the guy stopped sweeping, and he looked at me, you know, you jump in a car and you say everything is perfect. But he was doubting what I was saying. So he sort of came closer to me, and then relatively close, he said out loud, hey, junger Mann, bei uns der schnellste bestimmt. So basically, he said, in our car, the fastest decided. Because I said, if you can get the brake pedal a little bit back, then it would be perfect. Just the brake pedal a little bit back. And he goes, at our team, the fastest decide. And that's the only thing he said to me. And then he turned around and kept sweeping the floor.
Seat fit done.
Seat fit done.
But you did put in the fastest lap in the race, didn't you, I think, in the early hours?
Not in the early hours of Sunday. Yeah. I certainly didn't do it in the beginning, because I only got 17 timed laps at Le Mans in 1997. So I was pretty full of adrenaline at the beginning of the race. I had to, during qualifying, I had to fly to do a Formula 3, for I had to respect my contract to do a Formula 3000 test at the A1 ring, what now is known as Red Bull ring. So I flew down there with his private plane, a Joost, which he obviously still charged me for, to uphold my contract. So I was nervous, but that Stefan Johansson and Michele gave me so much comfort and so much confidence in the way they brought me into the team. Ralf Hüttner as well. Always the thing, they never told me what to do, but they really embraced me in the perfect way of having a rookie coming into Le Mans. So in that sense, it is the way they took, they didn't put pressure on me to tell me what they expected, but more, you know, find your rhythm and then we go. All the things like that. And talking normally about Japan, speak with them about their Formula One career, just like talking eye to eye. That was, for experienced drivers, that's something I really learned. And the way that particularly Michele embraced me, that's something I never ever forgot. Certainly also not when we got younger drivers, when I was the old guy. It was very important the way we get new rookies coming in, very talented drivers, but they didn't have to prove themselves on the first laps.
Yeah, and you said you were very nervous at the start of it, but you must have relaxed into it, because I think during the night you did three stints, which is about the max people did then, and then they asked, well, if you're happy, do a fourth. You must have then known then, this is going okay.
We were running near the podium, and when I was in the car the second time, it was really in the middle of the night, around 3 a.m. And through my third stint, that's when the radio call was a bit different than just on the German Boxenstopp, Sprit, when they say pit for fuel and keep going. Suddenly in the third stint, he came on and said, schnellste Runde, sehr gut, sehr gut. Means fastest lap, really good. And you know, that's really lovely to hear when you're driving out there in the night and you're just delivering and looking for that rhythm. And now it's 5 days and I'm looking for that rhythm all the time. But it just kept coming and kept getting better. So when you get that news, it's fantastic. And then what hasn't happened, in my 18 starts at Le Mans, maybe I'm a little, maybe it's more than 10 laps, but it's likely not much more. And I got one there, and that was a clear lap. And then after that clear lap, and the dawn was kicking in, and I was able to see a little bit more, as you know, finding the apexes better and better.
I don't know about that.
It was.
Never seen one in my life.
No, that's not true. But the car must have found some at times. And then when I got the next message, it was, lap record, keep it steady now, Tom, keep it steady. Ralf Jüttner's voice in, you know, when you get a German to speak to you in English, that's really something which is,
you've done all right.
Which makes, which took some weight off my shoulders. And at that point, it was really important. And then they asked for 4 stints. And I immediately just said yes, without thinking, without hesitating. And that's a little bit, probably, that hurt a little bit towards Jürgen, the mechanic who was sweeping the floor, just to say, yeah, I can do a 4 stints. But in the 4 stints, I was close to cramps because, of course, the seat was not perfect.
Nor the brake pedal.
Nor the brake pedal. I mean, no, it's not true, but it was. But it's just I used so much energy trying to get into that rhythm. So honestly, I learned the first year, it could very easily in the 4 stints have been a disaster because if I had to stop with cramp, which you are, if you're getting cramp in a race car, you stop and you lose so much time. Yeah. And you are actually the victim of the making the whole team as a victim. Yeah. So it didn't happen, but I was really, really close. And later on, we were close to the leading Porsche that we had closed on. And then sort of the key moment was certainly for me during these times. And Ralf also later told me that was the time when I was able to get to the pace of my teammates. He thought that there was a chance that we could win. And the anecdote which he has told is that at the same time, Michele was getting ready after the third stint to take over from me. And he arrives at the pit wall and is ready and is happy to see that we are going well. And then he heard the lap time about the lap record and he said, oh, to Ralf, he said, oh, fantastic. The circuit seems to be really, really fast. And where Ralf, he replied to Michele, yeah, especially for our car. Yeah. Which is always a good point. But the 4 stints, I have to say I was lucky because there I was close to being stupid in accepting the 4 stint.
How did I don't know off the top of my head either. How long is 4 stints?
It's close. It's 4 hours is the maximum you are allowed to drive. And the 4 stints back then, it's nearly 50 minutes times 4. So it's going to be 3.5 hours maximum.
Blimey, it's a long time. And then you won first time out. Did you, looking back now, did you appreciate the enormity of what you'd done?
Not quite, but I was of course extremely proud, extremely happy. But when I got in the car the next time, I got so much potassium, I got so many bananas because I was afraid of the cramp feeling I had early in the morning. But when I got in the car, I was in the car when the leading Porsche retired. We had been closing on them all morning, and then they had a temperature issue. And when they burst into flames, I passed the car after the second chicane, and I was on the radio and said, "Did you see that? Did you see that?" And of course, you are excited, but you also see you are afraid of what happened with the driver. And I saw, fortunately, Ralf Kellner had jumped out of the car. And of course, was devastating, leading Le Mans. And that was sort of also the reply I got from my team. Hey, focus, focus, focus. We saw it, focus. And that was the reply back to me. But I would say the confidence I got back when after the team we had, it was a one-car team. There was just 12 mechanics. And I had they had the Weissbier from Hofbräu. They had the sausages barbecued up at the team tent after. And the mechanics, at this point, they sort of started to talk a bit to me, you know. a little bit. Very experienced Jost mechanics. And that was good. They were happy. And there I got the confidence to my beer just to go over to Jürgen. You know, the guy sweeping the floor, put my finger in the back and just whispering to him that, Jürgen, next year, the brake pedal. little bit back.
Yeah.
That's. But you see, it's small things.
Yeah.
And small things could also have turned out wrong. If I had got cramp, I might not have been sitting here. You know, there are small things which is always creating destiny.
Well, we're going to move on to sort of the other side of Le Mans, which I'll call it. But just, I should have said at the start, there's going to be an opportunity for all of you to, well, maybe not all of you, because we might be here till midnight, but lots of you to ask questions at the end. So, you know, do have a think of any questions you'd like to ask. And Jason, up at the back, is going to be jogging around with the microphone. So please think of some questions. I've mentioned the other side of Le Mans. In 98, you had a big scare between Mulsanne and Indianapolis, was it?
Yeah.
And then Emanuele Pirro obviously had a terrible time when he first went to Le Mans. And so many people have had big accidents and it hasn't ended well. You must have been aware of that side of it throughout, from the first laps you did through to 2014.
I think, not every lap, but you have moments. There's obviously a lot of traffic in that sense, and there's always some, you have to shave pretty near by when you're overtaking. I think the 98, what you think is what there was with BMW Williams, and we had a super low aero car. It was with the Raffanelli team running the car. I was with Steve Sober and Hans-Joachim Stuck. And the BMW asked me to qualify the car, you know. I came there, I had the lap record from the previous year. We had car number one. So there was great expectations. There was a lot of good and strong cars. But in qualifying, the circuit was drying. And by the time I come off the wet tires to intermediates, the speed went up, less resistance, more top speed. And then suddenly going down to Indianapolis at the kink, the last kink, which is also famous later on, a couple of years later, we saw another car with a German manufacturer near Stuttgart, not Porsche, when they lift off and went airborne. And fortunately, with that time with Peter Dombrek, everything was fine. So this is 2 years earlier, and I had a similar, very close call. I am just getting up to the speed, and suddenly at the kink, I just feel the front washing out. But you're doing 332 or something like that. So you're really fast, and when the steering gets light, it's just a reflex being put the foot on the left foot on the brake pedal. And just stabilizing a little bit, but I ran out of road and I was on the grass, but the car dancing on the grass, thanks God it didn't dig in. And I just brushed the barrier a little bit and bring it back to the circuit on the radio. Hey, big trouble. I lost the steering arm or something like aerodynamically, issue. And driving into the pit, into the garage, and engineer, the Italian team, they look at it and checking everything, they lift up the car. And after a minute, they say, oh, everything's good. Boom, I buckle up because Steve Sober, he said to Tom, if you're not, I'm ready to qualify. He is a racer, so he was already ready. So when I jumped Steve's up, I said, Steve. And Steve, he didn't want. So then they looked a few minutes later. And then from the back room, actually, Patrick Head was there present at that time because the car was built with Williams. And Jason Summerscale, the aerodynamist, they have found that it was right, that suddenly there was something between 30 to 40 meters where the front the dampers, they could see that they were getting no pressure on. So I was very, very close to have taken off. And what happened was there was an issue on the floor where the floor with some, the way they have sort of connected it. That was a mistake in the way they have assembled that. So they fixed it, and I think it took them about 20 minutes, and we were running out of time because there was not much time left in qualifying. And they said, now we have fixed it, Tom, and put me on slicks. And I went out, and I did 10 or 12 minutes. So obviously, I did two or three laps, and we qualified, and we were ready to race. But I would say at that time there was a bit of pressure. Mm.
And so, interestingly, at the members' meeting at Goodwood earlier this year, you drove the GT1 98, the Porsche, which was quite odd seeing you in it because that was your rival car that year. And I spoke to you before you went out, but I haven't heard. And so, what was it like?
It was really nice to drive and also to speak to the mechanics, because, and that's what Goodwood can. You know, I drive the rival Porsche GT1 winning car from 1998. And back then, we could have a sneak into the garage and try to look, and they would close the door or whatever. Or car. And vice versa. And then a Goodwood, you can drive it. But it, at Le Mans, actually, my first stint, and I started the race, and obviously from a bit further back, as we had a bad qualifying, as I explained. But we were going really well in the race. And I think after 5 or 6 laps in the first stint, I passed our sister car with Pierluigi Martini, got the car all the way up to third when I before I headed up to Sauber. But in that period, I was racing with Alan McNish, who won Le Mans 1998. And our low aero was that when we left Tête Rouge, he was quite close to me. But then the first straight, look in the mirror, quite further back. Next straight, even further back. When I get to Indianapolis, I can't really see him in the mirror just. Then after Anas to Porsche, and then at Porsche corner, he's coming closer. Middle of Porsche corner is very close. Exit Porsche corners, he's right on my tail. So you see how much aero difference there was with the car. And this certainly I felt when I drove the Porsche in very efficient, a lot of aero. And a very very good balance, and with the BMW, very good in top speed, incredibly fast, low aero, bit too much sliding on the tires, but also good fuel economy as we didn't have so much aero, and we could do 1 or 2 laps more than the others. But the disaster was that when Steve then drove it, he was called 6 or 7 times to stop, and he didn't want to stop because he was told to stop. Basically to give up the race, as we had a wheel bearing issue as a supplier issue in 1998. The other car had retired some laps before, and they realized the wheel bearings were getting too hot, and obviously you don't want any of that at 340 kilometers an hour on the straights. But Steve, as you agree, his racer heart, he just ignored the call and said, no, it cannot be, and kept discussing. And the different people came on the radio, and I guess more higher in the hierarchy of BMW. And all right, he stopped. And it's quite difficult because the car was still running well. He was in 5th or 6th at that time.
Did you speak to Alan after driving the GT1?
Yeah. Again yesterday in Paris.
Yeah. No, it must have many happy memories for him. I want to talk about, obviously, Audi, because it's such a big part of your career. And the R8, let's just talk about the R8 a bit, because we've got a video that I wanted to show, but we'll do that in a couple of minutes when we talked about the R8. Because that, you went to go and meet Audi, and I think you shook hands there and then.
Yeah, I had the 2 years with BMW. Now we talk about the disaster. Yeah, the following year, 99, I had the biggest lead we have ever had at Le Mans. And if I may say that, I felt a long time we could win. Certainly even the 17 minutes after JJ had the crash, 3 hours before the end, 3.5 hours before the end, as there was a suspension failure on the damper. So it was my biggest disaster. But 17 minutes, we were still leading after we had retired. That's a big lead we have had. But of course, everything happens for a reason, and the winner is the winner, and it was not us in 99. But BMW pulled out because they went into Formula One, and our sister car won in 1999. So obviously, fantastic, your brother wins, so you're very happy in the family. But I had to look elsewhere. And then I went to Audi. They would like to see me. And I visited Dr. Ulrich and been shown around the sort of what I can say now, the old workshop, which is an old factory in near and next to sort of the Audi factory itself. And they have a lot of bungalows because the team had sort of extended a little bit, but it was rather small. But Dr. Ulrich showed me around after we had our initial agreement, and he met the mechanics, saw what they had planned, saw the drawing of what was then the R8 LMP1 car. And it was really fascinating. And at that time, we gelled very well. And we gave each other a handshake that I would I wanted to go to Audi. There was a lot of other opportunities, which there was not really before in my career, but certainly due to my first years now at Le Mans, I had the luxury problem of being able to choose, which was, of course, very remarkable for a small kid from a gas station in Hobro.
we all think of Audi now as multiple Le Mans winners. They've done DTM. They've done so much in the last few decades. But actually, when you walk through that door, they hadn't achieved that much in motorsport in recent years. So, I mean, did you feel as though it was a gamble, or were you quite confident that what they had was what you needed?
Yeah, it certainly was. I mean, there was a lot of people telling me. Certainly, even people from BMW, they said, don't go there. They were sort of laughing because we had driven in circles around Audi at that point in 1999. So there was a lot of people telling me it would be a wrong move. But I had a very good feeling. So not saying I was in doubt, but it's really great. You have the ability and possibility to race with somebody you feel attached to, and that feeling I had with Dr. Ulrich and the people I met on the floor in the garages. So I felt pretty good, and I didn't have to wait long to have that confirmed, as we went testing with their 98 front or monocoque with the rear suspension of what would be the car for the following year, for 2000. And Magnesia as well had signed. So we were both joining the Sebring test. And at that point, we both gave our feedback. So one from Porsche, one from BMW. And I think that sort of all gelled with Audi's already very experienced lineup of Frank Bieler, Emanuel Pirro, Dindo Capello, and Michele Alboreto. So in that sense, it was was a lot of experience coming into Audi at that point. So winning Sebring 3 months later with Bieler Pirro, it was confirmed. It was the right thing to do because I could go past the BMW tent and say...
Drivers tend to say that when you get into a good car, you know within a lap. No. Is that true with a sports car like the R8?
Yeah, not within a lap, and certainly not at Sebring, because Sebring, as you know, is...
You spend most of the time off the ground.
Yeah, off the ground and five different kinds of tarmac, but what the initial issue were, they were really bad Audi on the bumps, and when that was solved, it became a lot more stable and a lot more drivable. And, initial things like they had the cooling on the front of the car and on the 99 car. So it was incredibly hot for the driver and the feet and the way. This was all changed with putting beautifully at the side for the R8. And the R8, learning from their first initial car to the R8, which became it is the most successful car at Le Mans history, because five times the R8 model from different teams. As you know, I raced for many different teams, but just with the R8 alone, it was for three different teams. The official Audi team, and then the Go team, the Japanese little team, and Champion Racing from America. But five times, and I was, of course, fortunate that I was five times, I was one of the drivers.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
One of the extraordinary facts about your career is between 2000 and 2005, you won 6 Le Mans on the trot.
Yeah.
I mean, extraordinary. And one of those years was with Bentley. And I do always hear some people saying, oh, Bentley, it's just an Audi with green paint on it. But it's, well, I was talking about it with you this afternoon. It's not, is it?
No, it's not. And I happen to know there's a very detailed book coming out about Bentley. It will come out this year. It's 20 years since that victory. And it's 20 years since that victory was celebrated next door here at the Savoy. But I don't think we should go in detail about that that party.
Just before we brush over it. who did you sit next to? Just tell me how that happened, because it is quite...
Everything after Le Mans, everything happened quite fast. There was planned this great drive through Paris from the Champs-Élysées to the Eiffel Tower, and there was so much traffic. There was so hot, incredibly hot. Derek Bell, the ambassador of Bentley, drove the winning car, and we were all on Bentley blowers, the drivers behind, celebrating our 1-2 victory. The engine has not been started since after it was parked at the Eiffel Tower. So a few days later, we should more or less on this PR tour, we should have the team celebration with the sponsors and friends of the team here at the Savoy. And I happened to come alone. So I was asked by the boss and said, Tom, I've arranged, with the wind drives, you will be at the head table. And is it all right? You will be sitting next to the daughter of Wolf Bonato. And immediately go, yeah, hey, yeah, wonderful. Not realizing that she's obviously an old lady. She was 85 years old. So I have to say I've never experienced an evening like that. I was not aware of her pedigree. And she was the first woman to fly through the sound barrier. She is absolutely even more brave than her father.
But you had her doing pit stop practice.
Yeah, but that was her. So we did, in the middle of the ballroom after dinner, we did. She wanted to sit in the car, and we wanted to time the exit and entry. And she was a very remarkable woman. And we kept a little contact, and unfortunately she passed away in May, I believe it was, in 2008. So she didn't see sort of our win at that time with Capello and Magnesian, which was certainly a very good year. I didn't answer you with the Audi. It's not an Audi at all. The Bentley is a British-built racing car by RTN, designed by Peter Ellery. And you can say it's 100% British, but it's true that, of course, the Bentley racing program was only possible due to Volkswagen Group bought a Bentley, and they wanted to go marketing as you go racing, and they wanted the Bentley Continental. What a lovely road car it is, was built at the same time. But the car is absolutely entirely British. It has an Audi engine, which is a little bit bigger volume due to the rules of having a GTP car, which is a closed prototype, whereas the Audi was an open top car. So they had a little bit narrower tires, a little bit more hoopom, a little bit more engine capacity, but then the efficiency from a closed car on top speed. But nevertheless, they were there for 3 years, and I joined them in 2003. And what a good year it was, and what a party it was here next door.
Let's talk about Audi, but before we do, I'm sure some of you have seen the film. It's called Truth in 24, and it was a film that was done, I think, 2008. And this is a four-minute clip from it, but we thought earlier that it sums up so much about why Audi was so successful. So let's see if we can watch that.
The Audi strategy has taken everything into account, including the weather. Because it always rains at Le Mans.
This is what we've got on the weather. You've seen it.
We have our own weather system there, we have our own radar. We can predict rain to 3 minutes. So we knew the rain was coming.
Did note, for your information, we next get to Mulsanne Corner and Porsche Curve, there could be some very, very light drizzle.
Audi's moment has arrived.
We knew it would be a big advantage, and we were ready for it. Simple as that.
Box this lap. Full service.
Two cars in here. Driver change taking place. Capello did about 3.5 stints there.
And Tom is in.
TK is in.
By the time Christensen climbs into the car, Villeneuve's lead is down to a minute. The Formula One, an Indy 500 champion, is no match for Mr. Le Mans.
It's still going to be the same weather for the next 40 minutes, at least.
When you think of comfortable driving, this isn't it. Dark, greasy, traffic.
Going late around the outside there of that slower GT car. Now the road looks clear for a little bit.
You look up in the monitor and the pitch black and the big raindrops are coming down and you see them going, you know, 310, 315, 320. You know, it's pitch black. And you just get, you know, it's amazing. It's an amazing thing.
At night, when you are on the right tires, you get into the rhythm. You really feel like you're one with the car. The very fast corners, you don't see the apex of the corner before you're actually there. So you drive really a lot on your determination. You drive a lot on your confidence. And at night, when you are fast, there's nothing better.
Is on top, but Tom Christensen is chasing him down. The gap now just over 10 seconds, so TK taking sometimes 7-8 seconds a lap out of Villeneuve's lead.
Crew, be on standby, be on standby. And I want the inters out, but we stay on the same tyre.
And as Tom rolled down there, the margin between he and Villeneuve was just 2.9 seconds.
They pit at the same time. Audi adds only fuel. Peugeot also changes tires and drivers. By the time Villeneuve is out of the car, Christensen is long gone. So is Peugeot's lead.
TK in the position he relishes, out front.
Wow, yeah, I mean, it's pretty worse. We'll talk about the 2008 race in a second, but just, I mean, driving at night with traffic, and Le Mans is so much about the traffic. How, you say you get into rhythm, but how can you? Because you've got not only pro drivers, but you've got amateur drivers as well. What, I mean, what is the secret?
No, but I mean, driving at night, that's actually, in some ways, you can be more comfortable in traffic, honestly. Because you know they are aware that you are behind with the headlights. So actually you can take, I'm not saying bigger chances in that sense, because you only take calculated risk in that sense. But for sure here, we are talking about very heavy rain. So that's a different way to find a rhythm, because you don't find a rhythm. You kind of survive the point and move to the next one. And you always feel in the rain that you're giving away lap time, because you have to be careful, you have to brake earlier, you have to lift over when the car is aquaplaning on lift off, and kind of sort of predict what the car is going to do. And every time you do that, you feel mentally that you're giving time away, because what you're used to in the dry is flat. So everything, when you're working the throttle, you feel under pressure because you give away. And that's the mental, is to find the balance. So that's why I don't know, desperate or not, but I ask lap times of the direct competition, and I ask twice. So it's kind of this military way of explaining. And Houghton H, the main engineer, is sitting with Lina Gate. Lina Gate was our data engineer sitting on the pit wall there. Always, they don't give one information, they give two informations because you know you need to take it in. And as a driver, sometimes you hear they're talking, but you hear they're talking, then you start listening. So in that sense, because you're actually busy with other things, you only want to have communication when after you're accelerating onto the straight. But in the rain or in the night, when you're constantly fighting aquaplaning as well, you don't want anything to disturb that sound of silence, because when you, you know, when the car goes silent, you know you're aquaplaning. And at that point, you are the most, you have to be the most, you know, sensible guy. You have to lift the throttle a little bit and certainly not do anything with the steering and just hope. And you have to catch it back. And that's that, that's for me the biggest challenge. That's rain at Le Mans. And as Jason Statham, who is narrating,
probably his best
clip,
film actually.
It's a, he said always rains at Le Mans.
Yeah.
And that, that's kind of true. And that was very important for us that year because Peugeot were in the dry, really putting the hammer down. In qualifying, we were 3.5 seconds slower, which is a lot. Even at Le Mans, a lot. But in the rain, we, with our open top, we had our advantages. We were kind of seeing the weather forecast, so we were doing a few things to try to optimize. So at least we knew that in the rain, we could go all out. And that's what we did. The whole team, the mechanics, in the pit stop, Houghton was as a key element in the way he was pushing things. Of course, my wonderful teammates, Alan McNish, I mean, he only knows one thing, and that's maximum in whatever he does. And with our with Capello, brilliantly fast, smooth, lovely team player, best team player of them all, I can imagine, of my experience. I mean, the Italian guy. So in that sense, we had a perfect race, and we needed a perfect race to beat Peugeot 2008. And I think you have some of your writers called it.
It's the greatest Le Mans race. It's certainly been voted that way. I think the thing that gets me with Audi is that when they came into sports car racing, they looked at what happens and things break. There's no way, you know, gearboxes are always a weak spot. So they designed these cars, you could just take the entire back end off.
Yeah.
And I think, was it 2002 where you came in on three wheels?
They did it a few times during the period. But for me personally, what was very much the key was 2001, where the gearbox actually broke, the fourth gear broke, and they had expected that because we had some issue during the night, dog to dog. So every time when we changed to fourth, we were told to stay flat. We now had, you know, my first Le Mans was with H-pattern gearbox with the Porsche, with the BMW it was a sequential gearbox just up and down. But then with Audi, already I suddenly had power steering and we had paddle shift. But obviously that means that it's only every time you change gear that you can only do it in one way. And in 2001, there was 19 hours in the wet. So a lot of times we have this difficult to get the traction down, you're short shift and or you were coming off the throttle because you couldn't, you were sliding with the rear. And so the gearbox was really, really struggling. And then I ran out of fourth gear, broke in the middle of the day. On Sunday, we were in the lead and we have been really pushing hard. And the engineers tell us, keep pushing hard because we might have to do what then at the end of the day happened. I lost the drive and changed gear up, low rev, being told to go straight into the pit lane and straight into the garage. And I jump out of the car and they just go full attack. And I see so many mechanics working on the car. I'm standing at the wall, taking off my helmet. Bieler is jumping into the car, and it's just they're working incredibly hard, and it looks like a big casino. But I follow with the eyes, and I see one of the mechanics. That's Uwe. Uwe is the chief mechanic on the yellow car, our sister car, who's running second, which is still on the track. And I just follow him and to see, hey, if he uses or maybe forget a screwdriver or something like that in the work.
Kicking tools out of the way.
Exactly. Yeah. So I just follow him and I just try to look at the others. Have you seen? Have you seen Uwe is working on the car? And 5 minutes, few seconds later, the car goes out. They refuel the car, put on 4 new tires. The car didn't start. It didn't start. And then it started, and he drove off. And it just drove out, and maybe 12 or 14 seconds in front of the yellow car. Right. And I still look at Uwe, and he turns around and goes berserk in German. Yeah. Geschafft. Neuer Rekord. New record. That's the fastest we have done. And I look at him like feeling my trousers just falling down and getting red in my face and said, Uwe, fantastic. Really, really well done. That shows the philosophy of Audi, that when you are asked to do a job, you do your job perfect you can. And actually, Uwe was, among other mechanics, there's Thomas, there's Fritz, there's Dieter, they're all really good. But I remember just Uwe was always trying to test that yet again. Because if they could change the module, if there was a problem with the suspension, other car had what you mentioned, the wheel coming off or having an accident, but they changed the module from the engine and back, differential, suspension, exhaust, gearbox, and they did it in less than 6 minutes.
Amazing. I think we've actually got a photo of the back off the car. I mean, it was a whole new way to go racing, but I think they then banned this, didn't they?
This was banned at the before the life of the R8. They banned that. I believe they banned it in 2003 or 2004.
Yeah.
But it was a good way to go racing. And Uwe is the guy laying over there on the right.
Stealing a wheel gun or something.
No, he just shows the true spirit. And that 5P that Audi stands for, you know, proper preparation prevents poor performance. And that just shows with a hand sign. So, as you know, any racetrack, it's full of sound, noise, whatever. But if somebody puts up the hand, it's just a sign to everyone to be alert. Hey, something's going on, or listen on the radio, or we need to do something. Everyone does it, but Audi did it earlier and did it really good, and I love that experience with them.
You mentioned sound there, the diesel car.
Yeah.
I've got to ask about that because, you know, you don't look at change lights. If you're driving a car all the time, you know, you just do it by sound. And when did you first test the diesel car? I'll tell you what, when did you first hear about it? Because you must have thought it was complete madness, didn't you?
Yeah, and that's also why I was so concentrated in 2005, where we were quite a lot slower than Pescarolo car. I thought they put a little ACO, damping on the R8 with 50 kilos more weight, less air restrictor, and a more narrow rear wing. And Pescarolo cars were really fast. And it was really important for me because I thought that's the last chance I will ever have to win Le Mans, because there's rumors about that the following year, if I stay without it, will be with a diesel car. So during the summer and during the Le Mans 2005, we have heard a little sniff about that. And then in, I think, end of November, beginning of December, probably beginning of December, I drove the car the first time. And there had just been an initial test, which was done by Frank Bieler. But my first time driving the car was actually in Paris. I drove it around the Eiffel Tower and around Trocadero. And this you can understand, that's pretty much a marketing effort to present our TDI 12-cylinder in Paris, because we knew maybe as well that Peugeot was also on the way. So the fight which we had the following years, and we just saw the clip before, we had a gigantic fight and a great respected fight with Peugeot. And I know Rob is in here and he's not so happy with that. Is that correct? Because you were voting for the lovely manufacturer from France with the golden retriever on the front bonnet there, you know, the right? Yeah. But they were they're obviously amazing team.
What was it like to drive the diesel?
Initially, a lot of power at low revs. The weight distribution of the car was wrong, so you had a lot of because not only the engine, the V12, you had drive shafts, gearbox, differential, everything was so large to take the enormous grunt that came from the engine. And then you talk about sound. So you hear the engine pretty fine when you're in the car until a certain speed. I would say around 220 kilometers an hour, 150, what's that, 140 miles per hour. Then it's sort of the sound takes over from the air. So start whispering from, you have the wind noise from the open cockpit. And then you brake and you hear it again. So it has this cool supersonic sound. I remember the Beretsky, who was the...
Beretsky
was the... he was the father of the engine, and he called the sound sexy. I didn't agree with him, but I agreed with that it had a way of kicking you in the ass, that you really had a lot of power.
But Juan Beretsky, sadly we don't have a photo of him, but if you haven't seen what he looks like, do Google him, because he looks like just the kind of guy that would build a diesel engine for Le Mans. Didn't he say that sound was wasted energy? I think that was, I seem to remember seeing that.
That's true.
Yeah.
And then he used the word I mentioned before.
Right. Okay. Before, we're going to come to do some questions in a bit. But I would just like to, because obviously 97, your first Le Mans, and then up, all the way up to 2014. I think you said the first Le Mans you had, was it 17 people for one car in terms of running it? What was it like by the time you finished?
We were times four cars, works cars. So I think I counted one time 153 in the book of when you take everything with, because there's the VIP hospitality, and when you take the whole thing, it was a lot of people. And the way in Germany it's done, it's not, everything is done on the surname, and that's but you're on first name with everyone. So it was a little bit complicated when you look at sort of the team book.
But it was
great. I had 16 different teammates over 18 years at Le Mans. I drove for how many different teams? I mean, there was Joost, then there was Raffanelli, then was a great Snitzer team. I really loved that with BMW 99. And then with the Joost, with Audi Sport Team Joost, which was then joined by Audi. Then there was Bentley. There was the Team Go, the little Japanese team. Single car again, like the first year with Joost. Then the champion team, and then back to Audi Works teams until my retirement. So I think in that sense, seven teams over the 18 years. So I met a lot of people, and I felt also the development over the three decades of the cars, mentioning before how the gearbox was and the engines also coming from a natural aspirated V12 to a twin turbo V8, in the end to a single turbo hybrid car with a V6 TDI engine, V12 TDI engine, twin turbo. So quite a lot of different the way it also developed, and also the light and the simple things like that. How that developed probably prolonged my career a little bit in the way that that also developed. In the end, you had laser high beam and LED. And in the first, on the US Porsche, it was small halogen pointing in probably
roughly.
Not in the perfect direction.
Extraordinary. Let's just quickly discuss Le Mans now, because you can measure the success of a championship or a race by many different ways, but surely the number of manufacturers this year, but especially next year, we're in a golden era, are we not?
We are absolutely in a golden era. I mean, the way that the centenary attracted, I'm sure there has been a lot of boardrooms, discussions on motorsport, and they go, hey, centenary, let's win Le Mans. That's going to be the biggest and best way we can market our great cars. And this has been going on, and at the same time, the good bridge with human sort of common sense between ACO, between FIA, between IMSA, and the sports car championships in the States with Daytona, with the 12 hours of Sebring, which is a race I really really love, and together with the World Endurance Championship, they have made that you can win outright with the same regulation in terms of the hypercars, where quite a lot of manufacturers goes with the works teams, and the LMDH cars, sort of from the American continent, is sort of more private team based, but of course fully supported by the manufacturers. So I don't think, if I mention, I might not mention all, but if you say the Porsche, Toyota, Ferrari, Glickenhaus, you say Cadillac, you say BMW, you say Acura, you have a Lamborghini, you have Alpine also in the bin, and you have, I don't know, have I forgot some, Peugeot, of course, Rob, I mean, who is, and... Sorry, by Collis with the Van Wall. So you have a lot of manufacturers combined with private teams, and that, so it is absolutely a golden era. And they go for the outright victory, and that's really, really fascinating. And that's the not only the heritage of centenary. It's easy to speak about a fantastic time, but I'm sure the next 100 years are going to be fantastic too. And I don't plan to hang around for the next anniversary. But certainly, I will enjoy Le Mans this year and in the years to come.
Yeah. Now let's. There's. They.
America and WEC merged. You know, sorted it out. And it's no fun having just Toyota and no one else winning.
No, but you might have Toyota winning. They are certainly the favorites.
Yeah.
Le Mans is never boring if you're in the car.
But I do think it's...
They're not in the car. They're sitting there watching the race.
I think, Le Mans...
The last 5-10 years, it's been boring.
Well, I'll tell you what, before we get into a heated debate, let's... Jason, have you got a microphone? And let's... I tell you, have we got any questions? Because I'm sure there's lots of people who would like to ask, or he's got one down at the front. Jason, what I'm going to do is I'm going to choose people at the opposite ends of the room just to keep the weight off. Yeah.
Hey.
So that's what happens with a free bar beforehand.
So I'm sure you reverse home when you go in the car.
So, across all the years and all the race series and all the laps you've done, what's your favourite? What car, what race, what lap? What's the perfect one that you remember the most?
I think when you're in the rhythm at night at Le Mans, so it's going to be a hot day during the night at Le Mans. And I would probably say 2005 in the R8, the last year winning with the R8, where we shouldn't have won due to the thing. That summer day, that summer night, that's the best. And if you sometimes can get a small feedback from the engineer, then you are it's absolutely wonderful. Then everyone else can sleep. But if I just get a little thumbs up, in a way, in the wording I read from the engineer, and I feel the next lap is going to be that tiny little bit faster, because that's what we are. We are trying to make the next lap a little bit faster all the time.
I'm going to do a quick follow-up question. Have there been times at Le Mans, even perhaps when you've won the race, that you found stints, ignoring the wet weather, found stints just really difficult and hard to gel with the car?
Yeah, not all the time, because you get to the rhythm, but for sure you can be fighting to get on the leading lap. You can be fighting that nobody should catch you. So there's always something on there. But at 2005, the later in that race, it was so hot that actually the asphalt broke up, and there was protecting a lead, and I just taken over the car. There was a slow puncture on my teammate Marco Werner. So when I got in the car, we knew that I had to stretch the fuel for at least two pit stop I could extend, that the stop would be a lap later. At the same time, the Pescarolo was coming back on us, so it was quite troubled. And as the asphalt broke up, at the end of the day, it likely turned out to be an advantage for us. But when you go through asphalt where it's sort of the sandy bit is on it, it's quite slippery. That's one thing, but the worst is to look for rhythm in the rain at night, and when the cars are aquaplaning and cars are spinning, that's absolutely the worst to find. Or with local rain. Local rain means that you are always at period of the track on the completely wrong tires. But if you don't sort of can find that if half the track is dry, you can't go on wets because you will kill the wets to be helpful for the dry because the area of Le Mans is so large. And that's what is special at that race. So you have to drive very carefully with the slicks and the wets. Or in hindsight, if it's so wet at that part and we think it's predicting to go in that sense, you go on the intermediates. But the calls are really much down to the pit. And you heard Howden before. They can predict down rain down to 3 minutes, as we have all the sectors A, B, C, D, E, F, and even G. We have as sectors to check where the rain arrives and how big intensity.
And do you have spotters for the rain as well as the satellite?
We mainly just have the satellite. But spotters we can have when it gets down to really that little bit of rain. And one year you had that local rain quite a lot was 2013, which was our last last win at Le Mans. And for many reasons, it was a tough race for everyone as we lost Allan Simonsen early in the race. And with the local rain, it made it,
tough.
As well, incredibly difficult.
Mm. Sorry, Jason, I just got carried away there. Have we got some more questions? Oh, there's one here. It's the grey end.
Yeah. Can you hear me? Yep. Okay. Over the years, you've driven lots and lots of different cars, and you've won with a lot. But is there any car that you haven't driven at Le Mans that you wish you had?
I wish I'd been braking a little bit earlier sometimes, but I don't think I really wish for something. But it's true that when I was in Japan, I was driving for Toyota. I see you have a nice Toyota shirt on, so I'll go a little bit in that direction. And there was a chance I could join them going TSO 10, the Group C car at that time, and I did test for them in Japan, and did well. But they wanted me to focus on the Formula 3 Championship, as it was a bit more with the Honda, with the Mugen, with the other teams. So I didn't go. I would love to have been driving at Le Mans with a Group C car. So either the Toyota, the Peugeot. Would have been nice that year as actually the Peugeot won that year. So, but I did one race with Toyota and with Jacques Villeneuve and Eddie Irvine at a small circuit called Mine in Japan. And nobody really knew that when I started at Le Mans. So that gave me a little bit of a head start to have been driving one race with Group C. In Japan, the same year I won the F3 Championship. Mm. So, for you, the Toyota.
No, I was thinking more sort of the Group C's and the Jaguars and stuff like that.
But the Jaguar, I mean, yeah, the Jaguar was obviously fantastic too, and a Danish first Le Mans winner from Denmark was John Nielsen, and I remember when I was doing karting and seeing him cross the finish line, that was also suddenly putting some motivation into me. But the Jaguar, as we mentioned earlier, is actually the chassis of the Joost Porsche. Is the Jaguar. But otherwise, Formula One cars, I would have liked to have driven some of those as well. But you know, when you go to a buffet, don't eat it all.
That's brilliant. There's a question of the fourth row. That's probably where I've been going wrong. That's exactly what I do.
Bit of a two-part question, but as an amateur international driver, I've been lucky enough to do 6 24-hour races and 3 at the Nürburgring Nordschleife, which I had thought you'd race there. But how would you think that would compare to racing at Le Mans for professional drivers, amateur drivers, in terms of the challenge of the circuit layout and what that presents?
I lived in my German F3 year. I lived very close to Nürburgring, and so I know the Nordschleife, the green hell, pretty well. And I was supposed to have driven there with DTM in 20 years ago. But actually, the CEO of Bentley pulled the plug on that because the 24-hour race was just a few weeks before Le Mans, as you well know. So I didn't race there. But the racing circuit, Nürburgring, it's a world's most sort of challenging and difficult circuit in that sense. And I think that's also why you don't race with prototypes or Formula One cars there anymore, to the state of what they are today. But obviously brilliant in GT cars and with touring cars as you have been racing. But really, really tough and technical circuit. In the rain, really, really, it's a naughty track. It really gives you a wrong feeling, wrong sensation of grip at different places. Sometimes under the trees, it's incredibly slippery. A lot of undulation. There's a lot of camber changes, a lot of blind corners, very narrow. And at parts, they obviously paint on the track. Even sometimes you think the next lap, they paint it a little bit more. and paint means less friction. And a lot of these things makes Nürburgring a racetrack where you really focus. At Le Mans in the old, I speak sometimes, one of the things we talked about with some of the older legends at Le Mans is that back in the day when there was no chicanes, they say it was brilliant, we could relax. And people think, you're so brave. And said, no, we're not brave, we actually are relaxing. We're in the long straights. Of course they are brave, but they are not thinking. They are thinking they're in comfort, they're relaxing. And sometimes back then they also drove just two drivers at Le Mans. But with the chicanes, of course, it's much more physical. You just go to nearly top speed, but just with the braking and that sense. But Le Mans is a lot faster circuit than Nürburgring, and that's why there's an element of an sort of an extra challenge there. But if there's a challenge for making mistakes more often, it's certainly the green hell, and I think the nickname of green hell it speaks for itself.
When I was lucky enough to work for Motorsport full time, I went to the Nürburgring 24 hours and did a piece on it. And we went off for a walk around the campsites during the night. Mm. I've never seen so much beer and porn in my life. It was extraordinary. And it's one of those events that you should all go and see, because it is, like Le Mans, the experience is extraordinary.
It's the Kölsch beer, normally from Cologne. There's a little bit more friction in that than in your lager.
but they're there kind of in the lead up, building scaffolding towers to what? I mean, it's amazing. Anyway, have we got some more questions down here?
So I can't ask my
I apologise. Yeah.
So the second part of my question was, could you tell us about your most memorable race more recently at Goodwood? And could you help me to get a drive there in either the revival or the
upcoming tour? Well, actually, as if we knew you were going to ask, we've got a photo of Tom at Goodwood in GT40. That's members meeting Gurney Cup, I think.
No, I don't know. It's a few years ago, maybe. Yeah. I'm not sure. But I drove this year in the members meeting. But anyway, speaking about that, I mean, we need to applaud the gentleman here. He won his first race at Goodwood last year in an NGB.
So, by luck.
Ed Foster. Ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, and literally everyone else fell off.
No, that's not true. But I drove at the members' meeting this year, and it was a splendid time, if I may. I drove in the Lotus Cortina, I think. How many were there?
30 Cortinas.
30 Lotus Cortinas.
Yeah.
I was in that race, and I had a lovely race in my race because I was not at the front, but I finished where? I finished six. And coming from, I was just outside of the top 10. It was a lovely fight with Darren Turner and Rob Hoff. And apparently, I drove my whole stint with the indicator on, which I had no clue I had, because there's no noise, there's nothing. But actually, from outside, it must have looked a little bit different. But actually, it did a bit on Rob, because I passed him into Matwick, turn one, with the indicator left, and I dived underneath him. And when it was sliding out, I just hoped, stabilize. And we didn't touch. And afterwards, I said, did you also feel we didn't touch? He said, yes, we didn't touch. But I think it was really close, and that's what it's all about. But I have to say, I put a little bit more into it right just there, because I really wanted to pass him. And I think that's sort of the memory, the latest memory of Goodwood. And for you to get a drive, that's easy. You you just turn up with your racing license, with your car, and you're in it. maybe call the Duke of Richmond just beforehand.
You can call the Duke. You can call the Duke of Richmond. He's on 078. Excellent. Jason, we had a question down the front here.
How do you keep such high levels of concentration consistently during such long stints in a race? Do you find you sort of discipline yourself and always use reference points for the braking zones and where to hit the apex, or does it just sort of become second nature? And I'm asking personally because my only good image of me racing is actually in the gravel trap, so the advice is appreciated.
Yeah. I tend really to look into the corner, so that means I hope it becomes second nature. I'm not, but for sure you can, when you go to new circuits, you know a little bit that it's here about, you have to start braking, and then I just brake a little bit less until I brake a bit less, and then I step by step, and then it hopefully becomes second nature by something like lap five, and that's what you try to, that's what you're aiming for, and sometimes it doesn't necessarily mature into that, but that's sort of the... That's the goal of it.
Excellent. We've got two questions over here. We'll come to you first. Well done, Jason. Your steps will be up today.
Staying on Goodwood, what is the oldest car you'd agree to drive?
No, but they're in period. I mean, and I think... Thanks for the question from the gentleman before. But I mean, I sometimes been asked to drive, and I agreed to all the cars I've been asked to drive. But I not tend to drive two cars when I'm there. And I think the Thunderbird was probably the one I sort of took a step or two back when I came to see the car. Yes.
Checked your will was up to date,
because that was. That was huge. I mean, we have my. I think our ferry in Denmark is smaller than that. But my very first time was in 2010, and you mentioned Emmanuel Pirro. I have and a few other drivers, Jochen Maas, have asked me, "Hey, you have to come to Goodwood to drive one day." And I said, "I will do that when I'm retired." I said, "No, you don't. You should be there." And then I got the invitation in 2010, and I turned up, and the first car was an Austin Westminster A95. And it was kind of beige. It was kind of a color you don't necessarily need a car in that color. And it had number 7, and I think they knew I like number 7. I'm born 7767, so... It's also the only thing which blew that was after my 7th win at Le Mans, I also won 8 and 9 times. So I think 9 is fine and is probably a better number. But that car I was having with Patrick Watts in the race. I had a nice fight with him, and he was in a Volvo Amazon. And talking about that, that he was running a bit out of grunt and he had a problem with the car. And I managed to see the checkered flag first on my debut. In a car which was probably from 1959, I believe. But winning with that car, that is talking about quite a lot about what Goodwood is. And that was certainly a wonderful moment. And I decided to celebrate it here in the great country of England by opening the door, releasing my and waving to all the spectators driving back in. And right after I got my trophy, I was asked to go up to the race control where they where they fondly find me with a little bit of money, and I happily paid. I was in control.
I should just say, Tom, correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I hear from drivers that share with Tom, is he turns up and he won't test the car beforehand. He gets in, and you'll sit there for 5-10 minutes just checking where everything is, and you'll say, "Yep, that's fine." And you go out and you go 4 seconds a lap faster than the owner, which must be infuriating. But you don't do any testing, do you? You just turn up and drive it.
I did test the first time when I came to Goodwood, but it was raining, and I had a lovely Audi RS6 from Audi UK. So actually, I was drawing the rain in the Audi RS6 and learned the Goodwood circuit back in 2010. Apart from, I did a test at Brands Hatch with the AC Cobra when I drove with Kenny Bragg for the TT race. I did test beforehand, but all the other cars, and there you can mention the short wheelbase, lovely Ferrari, you can mention the Lotus Cortina, you can mention the Ford Thunderbird, the Ford Fairlane, the Jaguar E-Type,
Ford
GT4. That's the only one I did test with. The rest I just turn up, and I think that's what it should be. The guest driver should just turn up, and because that gives the best. It should not be too professional. Of course, we do the best what we can when we're there, and sometimes it gels, and sometimes it doesn't. But nevertheless, we are there for the history, heritage of the sport, and the Duke of Richmond and all his people there are putting up a great show. And really understanding the history of our great sport, including yourself. I mean, you're quite easy to spot there in the paddock, yeah. Due to your obviously long legs.
moving on very swiftly, we had a question up here, didn't we? So, yeah, on the far corner. We've got time for a couple more.
It's probably a bit of a dumb question, actually. When you're at Goodwood, are you on the edge? In the same commitment as Le Mans, or are you playing?
No, I'm not playing. I have a lot of respect for driving both the car and the circuit. So I'm certainly not playing at all. I'm trying to do fine, but I don't drive. I don't want to go over the limit at all. That's the thing. But you want to find the rhythm. So I'm looking for the same thing I did when I was racing. And that is sort of the best way around. And that means with the low grip you have at this, we love to drive there. Because if you're not sideways before you approach the apex, you're not coming around the corner. So obviously you don't brake very hard on the tires because they lock up. So you sort of brake and put the car out and let the car flow. That's lovely. And this you don't need to sort of to push, because then you make mistakes. So you're trying to look for a little bit of a different rhythm. But it's true that sometimes, I mentioned before, I maybe put a little bit more into it, because now I've been sitting behind him for these 4 or 5 laps. If I just put a little bit more. So that's when I'm fighting with that, what we are talking about, going towards where you are on the limit. And that's where I'm fighting with myself, trying to not to do that too much. But for sure, I want to drive, and I do drive as fast as I can in this always. It has been so far new machinery. I think there's only been once where I have come back to the same car, and that's with the Ferrari short wheelbase.
It's not a bad car to come
it's
back
not, it's
to,
a, is it? It's a wonderful, yeah, wonderful yeah. car.
Yeah. All right, I think we've got time for one more. Here we go.
You're losing a little bit performance.
which year at Le Mans did you go the fastest down the Mulsanne straight, do you think?
In my time?
Yeah.
Was with the BMW in, probably in 98 with the lower aero. We were more than 350. And then in 99, we were 350. Maybe 351 in 99. And a little bit more in 98. But then that was too low on aero, which we learned from that. So obviously it was not a winning car. That was the end of the day, the Porsche. But we were strong. But during the night, we would probably have fallen a bit back.
Am I right in thinking also that down the Moorsand, because it's a normal road through the rest of the year, you do have sort of dents in where the cars usually go down it? It's not a completely flat surface, is it?
No, it's undulating a bit. I mean, it feels a little bit like you're coming out downhill after Tête Rouge. It goes a bit downhill, a dip, and then it sort of levels out. And then it's quite flat all the way until the second chicane. After the second chicane, you come out and it goes a little bit over the hump, which is also brushed off the hump. That was where one of the car manufacturers from Germany, not BMW, but in where they had, and we had earlier on a blue car, Kuro, from the same manufacturer, also at the time with the Group C. Over that hump, they were flying. That's eased out, but it goes a bit uphill. Then you have Mulsanne Corner, and after Mulsanne Corner, you're feeling going a little bit downhill towards the first kink, and between the next kink, it's kind of flat before it then has the hump before in Indianapolis. But there's not a lot of elevation changes at Le Mans compared to Nürburgring. Nürburgring, it's a lot more elevation within a short in short spectra, but the speeds are, of course, way higher at Le Mans. You are six or probably even seven times you are flirting with being more than 300 kilometers an hour. And when you look at the average speeds, I only know in kilometers of qualifying, that to be on pole, you need to break 250 speed kilometers an hour in average speed to qualify for pole. It's pretty fast. And you you need to flirt around more than 220 in case you want to win the 24 hours. And that's including pit stop and service, full service of more than half an hour. So if you add that in, your average speed during those 24 hours, 200 and plus 20 kilometers an hour. So everything is happening pretty speedy. So that's also why when you look at the cars, think of them with the average speed. So you look at them, they are whatever they are, but they are obviously aerodynamically and the airflow and everything is done to work at that speed. And amazing. That's what's amazing when you look at the different cars over the spectra of 100 years at Le Mans. And of course, the era, which I have been fortunate to drive, is certainly the fastest era in terms of end of noughties to the mid to 15. These were the times where we were fighting for the outright longest distance. I know that in 1971, I believe, was the longest distance before. Which was fantastic and was brave, but the track and circuit was really fast back then. There was really no corners, no chicanes compared to now. So in this period, particularly with the TDI engines and the hybrid class cars, the LMP1 cars, it has been an amazing period at Le Mans, and that we know we have a golden era in front of us. I don't think we will ever see the cars going that fast that they did in this period, which I just mentioned. But that was pretty cool to have been part of that from all of us.
Experience the thrill of the race with Scalextric, proud sponsors of the Motorsport Podcast.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.